Welcome to WhiskeyCast, cask strength conversation featuring news and interviews from the world of whiskey. I'm Mark Gillespie. This is episode number 296 for January 2nd, 2011. Coming up in a few minutes.
What you've got to remember in those days was that we made spirit for the industry. We actually kept very little ourselves because we didn't have a blending program.
That's Tim Morrison, managing director of A. Dewar Rattray, but who will be forever linked with his family's heritage at Morrison Beaumont. More with Tim Morrison later, along with the calendar of events, the emails of the week, and the What I'm Tasting This Week department. First, though, let's look at the news. It's brought to you by Glenmorangie. Let's update a story now from the last episode. Tuttletown Spirits co-founder Ralph Arenzo remains in critical condition at a hospital in Poughkeepsie, New York. As I mentioned last time, he was involved in a car accident on the Tuesday before Christmas and went through more surgery this week. Ralph's family continues to update his condition on the web and reports he is slowly starting to regain consciousness. I've posted a link to the website at the WhiskeyCast website, and you can post messages for Ralph and his family there. In fact, family members have been reading them to Ralph to help with his recovery. Round two of Whiskey Magazine's Icons of Whiskey Awards is in. Last fall, we had the announcement of the Scottish Regional Icons, and now the U.S. winners have been named. In fact, Tuttletown Spirits was named the Craft Whiskey Distillery of the Year, while Four Roses was named Distillery of the Year overall. Fred Noe of Jim Beam was named American Whiskey Ambassador of the Year, while Laphroaig's Simon Brooking was named Scotch Whiskey Ambassador of the Year. Diageo was named Brand Innovator of the Year for its Masters of Whiskey network of brand ambassadors, and Maker's Mark was named as the Visitor Attraction of the Year. Binney's in Chicago was named Multiple Store Retailer of the Year, while Federal Wine and Spirits in Boston was named Single Store Retailer of the Year. There's one more round left for international icons, and the winners of all three regional rounds will go into the final Icons of Whiskey Awards announcement at Whiskey Live London this March. Word from Chris Bunting at the Nanjata blog on Japanese whiskey, another distillery is being reopened in Japan. The Hambo Spirits-owned Shinshu Distillery will reopen next month after being silent since 2002. It's been an open secret that plans have been in the works to reopen this distillery for some time. I had heard reports about it in September, but the official word is out now. Finally, Catoctin Creek is expanding outside the borders of Virginia for the first time. The micro-distilleries Organic Mosby's Spirit, Roundstone Rye, and Watershed Gin are now available in Tennessee. And that's the news. It's brought to you by Glenmorangie. Unnecessarily well-made. Let's wind up the ForScotchLovers.com trivia contest now with the answer to the final question. I asked you to name the distillery that fits this description. It opened in 1875 near Portsoy in Scotland, and while it's currently operating, has been closed at least three times. The answer is Glenglassaugh, and Chris Van Strander is the final winner of a $50 gift certificate from ForScotchLovers.com. His answer was picked at random from all of the correct ones as this week's winner. Thanks again to Doug Stone and the folks at ForScotchLovers.com for sponsoring the trivia contest the last several months. You still have about 3 weeks left to enter Isle of Jura's Wish You Were Here Travel Photo Contest. The entry deadline is January 21st. Weekly winners get an Olympus digital camera and three grand prize winners from the UK, North America, and the rest of the world will each win a trip to Jura this August, a stay at the Jura Lodge, an Olympus Pen digital camera, and a photography masterclass with National Geographic photographer Jim Richardson. You'll find a link to enter at the WhiskeyCast website, and even if you're not a photographer, you can still vote for the entries each week and be entered in the weekly drawing for a bottle of Isle of Jura 10-year-old whiskey. The Wish You Were Here contest is sponsored by Visit Scotland, Olympus, and Isle of Jura, in a world of its own. Now let's check the emails of the week brought to you this time around by Highland Park. Heard from Gene Fisher this week. Dear Mark, thanks for bringing a great little book to our attention, Ian Buxton's 101 Whiskies to Try Before You Die. After hearing about it on WhiskeyCast several episodes ago, I dropped a hint to my wife that the book would make a great gift for Hanukkah. The book is nicely produced. Each entry has a short but informative description of the whiskey, including tasting notes and a color photograph of the bottle. My only complaint is that the book was all too short. Too bad the title isn't 1001 Whiskies to Try Before You Die. I highly recommend the book to WhiskeyCast listeners. I'll bet, like I did, they'll find themselves making a note every few pages on what whiskeys to try next. Mark, please keep up the good work. I look forward to each week's podcast. Happy New Year to you and your listeners. Yours truly, Gene. Well, Gene, thank you for the note. This was one of my favorite whiskey books of the year, too, and I'm glad you liked it. On New Year's Eve, I asked Facebook followers to post their drams for celebrating the arrival of 2011. Had way too many responses to list them all, but some of the more frequently mentioned choices, the Famous Grouse, Ardbeg Supernova, and Compass Box Flaming Heart, along with a few different bourbons. Also, we had a lot of Dram Cimber drams posted. You can check all of them out at the WhiskeyCast Facebook page. Joshua Scott in Noblesville, Indiana, asked me on Twitter where he might be able to find a set of the Malt Project DVDs at an affordable price, since the entire set sells for $156. If you're not familiar with the Malt Project series, it's a set of documentaries with visits to more than 50 distilleries in Scotland. It's not currently available anywhere on eBay, but if you have a set you're thinking of selling, let me know. I'll put you in touch with Joshua. My email address is comments@whiskeycast.com. You can also reach me on Twitter @WhiskeyCast or through the WhiskeyCast Facebook page. And the emails of the week are brought to you this time around by Highland Park.
Hello, this is Jerry Tosh of Highland Park, the makers of the best spirit in the world. If you'd like to go onto the WhiskeyCast website and click on the banner, then it'll take you to the inner circle and sign up, and we'll send you as much information about Highland Park as you'd ever need to know.
Time now for the calendar of events, brought to you as always by Laphroaig. Since we're starting off a new year, I thought it would be good to mention some of the year's major whiskey festivals now so you can start making your vacation plans. Whiskey Live London is March 4th and 5th, followed by the Whiskies of the World Expo in San Francisco, March 26th. Malt Advocates Whiskey Fest Chicago is April 15th. The Spirit of Speyside Festival runs from April 28th through May 3rd. By the way, tickets for the Spirit of Speyside events go on sale January 14th. The Limburg Whiskey Fair is May 14th and 15th in Germany, along with the Spirit of Toronto Festival May 14th. The Isla Festival of Malt and Music is May 21st through the 28th. The Kentucky Bourbon Festival is September 13th through the 18th. The Autumn Speyside Whiskey Festival is September 29th through October 3rd. Malt Advocates Whiskey Fest San Francisco is October 7th, followed by Whiskey Fest New York on November 1st. Finally, Glasgow's Whiskey Festival is set for November 19th. Of course, there are many, many more events coming this year, and you'll find a full calendar for the year at the WhiskeyCast website. It's brought to you by Laphroaig. Just click on the Laphroaig banner at the WhiskeyCast website to become a friend of Laphroaig and claim your own square foot of Islay. Last April, I was in Glasgow for the World Whiskies Conference and had a rare chance to sit down for a chat with Tim Morrison. He's one of the sons of Stanley Morrison of Morrison Bowmore fame. His brother is Brian Morrison. And Tim is now the managing director of the independent bottler A. Dewar Rattray, which was founded by one of his ancestors, the legendary whiskey blender Andrew Dewar. I had originally hoped to run this interview during the Fagiel series as part of the episode from Bowmore, but to be honest, I was having a lot of trouble with my recording gear that day and thought I had lost this entire interview. In fact, you're going to hear Tim make a few references to James Espy of The Last Drop, who was one of the speakers that day we talked in Glasgow, and an interview I did with James did disappear. But fortunately, I was able to recover this interview with Tim Morrison. Tell me, first of all, how your family got started in the whiskey business.
To be perfectly frank, I'm not entirely sure how my family got involved, because both my mother's side and my father's side were involved in the whiskey business. My father joined my grandfather in, I think it was about 1930, and then he set up a broking business with Alan Lundy's father, and it was Lundy and Morrison. and then he went on his own. And in actual fact, it's quite interesting hearing James, because my father was responsible for selling Shivers Brothers to Seagram's in 1947.
And how did it go after 1947?
To be perfectly frank, I'm not sure, because I didn't come into the business until 1961 or 1962, because I had done my training with working up in Speyside with Arthur Bell, and then went to their bottling place in Leith, and then spent a couple of months at the North British Distillery.
How did the family come to buy Beaumont?
It's my father was having lunch in the old Malmaison restaurant in Glasgow, which was the number one restaurant in Glasgow, part of the Central Hotel. And he overheard a conversation between a Spaniard and Kay Grigger, whose husband had recently died but owned Beaumont. And he gathered from that conversation that the Spaniards were going to buy Beaumont. So he phoned Kay later that afternoon, went to see her, and persuaded her not to sell to them, but he would put together a company to buy both Beaumont Distillery and the Roseburn Bond in Bridgeton.
And this happened in 1963, and as we've heard before, with the legacy from the Black Beaumont of 1964, the entire distillery was rebuilt at that time, pretty much, right?
We rebuilt Beaumont about 1964, yes. There's quite an interesting video produced when we replaced the boiler and replaced one of the stills, and I don't know if you've seen it.
No,
because the point of it was that we took it over, but within in a tank landing craft, and some of the Navy had actually miscalculated the tides, because the point was that the tank landing craft would come right into the distillery, drop the bow and roll everything off. But it didn't happen like that, and our manager at the time, James McCall, says, "They've got it wrong. The tide is wrong. They're a week too early." And lo and behold, that's exactly what happened. And we had this tank landing craft sitting at anchor about 150 yards from the distillery. And eventually, at the end of the week, we managed to roll things off. But prior to this happening, on the Friday before it was going to be shipped from Dumbarton up to the Broomielaw by transport, McKelvey Transport, I was sitting in my office with the chap who was the finance director of Beaumont, chap Alistair Robin, and we said, "Do you think we should insure this operation? Because we were told if it had gone over 4 or 5 days, we were going to be responsible for the added costs." So at 10 to 5 on the Friday afternoon, we insured it. And thank God, because the whole operation took 2 weeks.
Tell me what it was like when you guys finally laid down that spirit, when your family laid down that first spirit that wound up becoming the legendary Black Beaumont some 30, 40 years later.
Well, of course, what you've got to remember in those days was that we made spirit for the industry. We actually kept very little ourselves because we didn't have a blending program. And so therefore we were selling it to other blending companies within the industry. And also remember that in 1963, single malts weren't really something that anybody thought of, except in their own geographic area, whether it was in Speyside or whether, you know, Laphroaig or Lagavulin bottled an Islay. We certainly didn't bottle. And we didn't bottle until 1968. And then in 1971, just after my father had died, we started the single malt program because my father didn't want us to compete with our customers.
How did you resolve that with your... It obviously was resolved after your father passed, but what was the prejudice against single malts at that point?
I just think it was an untapped market. Nobody knew anything. Nobody knew anything about it. It was like at that time in the early 60s, 50s, people really didn't drink wine unless they were of a particular income category or had travelled or what have you. But by and large, as we heard James Espy saying, people drank beer and gin and whiskey, and that was about it.
Is it fair to say that that's the biggest change that's happened to the whiskey industry in your career?
Yes, I think so. But what you've got to remember, it's taken that amount of time to get malt whiskies to the level they are today. Whereas when we started, I mean, I think basically the industry sold about 100,000 cases of malt whiskey. But Glenfiddich have got to be given the credit for really developing the malt whiskey industry in terms of packaging and promotion and the distribution, of course, throughout the world. The great thing for them was that I think the distribution and retail operations were looking for something that was maybe a bit, how can I put it, different. And Glenfiddich were able to supply this product with the great new packaging, great new presentation, and then Glenlivet came in behind that, and of course the rest of the industry were fortunate enough to follow. And we certainly had, we started laying down whiskey in 1972 for the single malt program.
Why did those casks that were laid down in 64 that became the Black Blackmore, the White, and the Gold, why were those casks never sent off to blenders?
Mark, I couldn't tell you. I find it quite extraordinary that I think they were probably owned by people who bought a cask or two casks or three casks. Maybe we did fill a certain amount for ourselves, but my memory doesn't go back that far, I'm afraid.
What went into the decision by the family to sell to Suntory in around 84? If you can answer that.
Right. The basic reason was that in 85, 84, 85, 86, the industry was in a downturn. We were primarily involved in selling bulk fatted malt and blend around the world. That had taken a pretty serious dip. We had always been very friendly with the Tory family, and the industry has to thank the Japanese, Nikkei and Suntory, for supporting these companies that supplied malt at that time, for supporting them. But we felt that if we were going to grow the company anymore, we didn't, as a family, have the resources to be able to do that. And rather than going to the market and becoming a listed company, we thought the best thing was to, discuss opportunities with Suntory. Suntory really was the only company we ever talked to, although the odd company had maybe said, why don't we have a chat? But the two families, the Morrison family and the Tory family, were friendly and played a lot of golf together, and so, and my brother was very much responsible for that, my brother Brian.
And the Tory family obviously kept your family's name on the company to this day. Have they been a good steward of your legacy?
Oh, I think fantastic. I don't really think we could have had a better company looking after, as you say, our legacy. And I'm fortunate. I still have many friends in the company, and I have the greatest admiration for that company.
but you went on to found your own company, A Dewar Rattray. Tell me about the history of that and where the name comes from first.
Well, it comes, I had an aunt on my mother's side and through my maternal grandfather who owned two or three companies that they had bought during the 1900s. And one of them was this company, A. Dewar Rattray, that they had bought, I think, from a couple of grocers in the west side of Glasgow. And they were importers of Italian wines and vinegars, and they distributed products around the west of Scotland. And I felt that this was a good vehicle, that because I had quite a lot of bulk whisky, that I could start looking to develop a brand or a company.
And you went on from this to become one of the larger independent bottlers in Scotland, right?
I don't know, Mark, how large we are in comparison to other people. But yes, we have a good little team and a very committed team, and I think we are about to go through an interesting development, because my son is coming to join the company in the beginning of May, and he's worked in retail in the United States and did his training over there, and he's been involved in the marketing arena.
You also, at this point, a few years ago, came up with the Stronachie single malt. And I know this has, I've been told this has some connection to your family going back. Am I wrong on that?
No. What happened was that Dewar Rattray were the agents for selling Stronachie bulk whisky to grocery companies in the west of Scotland, because in those days the grocery companies actually used to fill whiskey for their own blending purposes, and the company the distillery closed its doors about 1909 or something like that, when the industry had a fairly severe dip, and then in 1930 they dismantled the machinery.
And you wanted to bring at least the name back, so you were able to find a distillery that was able to at least come close to replicating the original Stronachie character, correct?
That is correct, yes. I mean, it was a bit of a hit and miss, but we felt that we found a spirit that was as near to that product as it possibly could be, because we found an old bottle dating back to 1909, the Stronachie malt, and we took some little samples out of it, and we did some analysis, and I won't say the rest is history, but
I also know you're not going to tell me the answer to this, but can you say which distillery it comes from, because I've had that question asked before?
I won't tell you now, but I will tell you later.
Okay. Where does the future go for you guys and for the A Dewar Rattray business? As you said, your son is coming in to take over, or at some point, or at least to become the next generation. What's the future for not only A Dewar Rattray, but other independent bottlers, because we see more distillers that don't want to give up their stocks?
I'm very fortunate that I have a young team in Dewar Rattray. But what we have got to do is to continue to find, if it's at all possible, outstanding whiskies. Now, these become less and less as far as the industry contracts, and it's held by more and fewer and fewer companies. I like to think that, and it's interesting that James Espy have just said, that they are not a whiskey company, but a spirits company. And we bottle rum, we bottle cognac, we bottle Irish whiskey, and obviously Scotch malt whiskey. We've not got into the blended market yet, because I think that's a different thing altogether. What are the risks? The risks are that we can't find stock. and we've just got to try and overcome that. I think the important thing is we're fairly well financed, so we do have. And who knows, what about a micro distillery?
Might you consider buying a distillery at some point?
No, I couldn't afford to go and do that. I would have to have fairly hefty external finance to do that. But the other aspect of the micro distillery is a different ballgame altogether.
What impact do you think those are going to have? Because they're more prevalent in America, but there are a few starting to sprout up here in Scotland.
I think this is going to be very like microbreweries. And I think, again, you're going all the way back to the early days of developing a malt brand. I think these little distilleries will be able to establish their own niche in the market. But again, it will have to be marketing skill and selling skill that will determine how successful they are.
And that's where larger players can come in and help them, right?
I'm not entirely sure larger players will come in, because I don't think the volumes will be big enough to entice them.
What do you want your legacy to be in this business?
So far, my legacy has been Beaumont, and developing the malts and developing the brands. I would like to see my legacy in this legacy being giving younger people the opportunity to develop products within an area which has given me enormous pleasure and opportunity and kept my family together. And as James said, you know, you don't get a lot of fun out of meeting your friends to sell nails in the afternoon, but you do get a lot of fun selling whiskey and spirit and conviviality and friendship. And
since the interview last April, Tim Morrison has confirmed that Benrinnis is the source of today's Stronachy single malt. An 18-year-old version has also been added to the range. You'll find my tasting notes for the 12-year-old Stronachy at the WhiskeyCast website. Now, earlier I mentioned the New Year's Eve drams that many listeners shared on the WhiskeyCast Facebook page, so I thought I'd share my New Year's Eve choices in this week's edition of the What I'm Tasting This Week department. I started off with the Kuruozawa 1975 single cask bottling from No. 1 Drinks Company for La Maison de Whiskey. Cask number 6736 was an ex-sherry cask bottled at 61.8% ABV after 35 years. The nose, dried fruits, sherry, and cola notes with a hint of herbs. The taste was smooth and peppery, with notes of caramel cola and a hint of tropical fruits as the pepperiness faded. The finish, a hint of papaya, cola, and a slight pepperiness. Very smooth, very long. This malt won a gold medal in the recent Malt Maniacs Awards. I'm scoring it a 91. Next up, the Hakushu 18-year-old from Suntory, bottled at 43.5%. The nose is full of green apples, pears, sweet oak, honey, and a nice smokiness, very rich and very smooth. The taste also carries that nice smoky touch with a great mouthfeel, and notes of apples, pears, figs, and a slight peppery note. The finish is smoky, dry, and slightly lemony. Overall, very smooth. I'm giving the Hakushu 18-year-old a 93. And as the clock struck midnight, I was sipping a 42-year-old Strathila from Duncan Taylor & Company's Lonic series of bottlings. This one was distilled way back in 1967 and bottled in 2009 at 41.1% ABV. The nose is creamy and smooth with notes of honey, toffee, orange peel, and a hint of bubblegum. The taste is young and very vibrant despite the age, with spicy touches of nutmeg and cinnamon, and the finish has touches of cinnamon, oak, and red grapes. Very well balanced and outstanding. A great dram to ring in the new year. I'm scoring the Duncan Taylor Lonic Strathila 42-year-old, and that's a mouthful. I'm scoring it a 94. Of course, your own tastes may vary, but you can compare your notes with mine at the WhiskeyCast website and with the free WhiskeyCast smartphone apps for iPhone and Android. The iPhone app is sponsored by the Glenrothes, and the Android app is sponsored by Ben Romick. You'll also find links to the Whiskey Cast Facebook page and my Twitter feed at the Whiskey Cast website, along with the calendar of events, details on the Wish You Were Here photo contest, the Whiskey Cast store powered by Amazon.com, and a complete archive of past episodes. By the way, as I'm recording this, there are just 4 sets of Whiskey Cast 5th Anniversary Glencairn Crystal glasses left. Only 25 sets were produced. $10 from each set goes to Charity Water. You can order them through the WhiskeyCast website, too. The address is www.whiskeycast.com. And my email address for questions and suggestions is comments@whiskeycast.com. WhiskeyCast is a production of Cask Strength Media, copyright 2011, and comes to you from the charming, yet regrettably dry town of Haddonfield, New Jersey. I'm Mark Gillespie, reminding you that when you drink, please drink responsibly. Happy New Year, and thanks for listening.